Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Today, I'm with David Ellis, who is former CEO, I think that's right, of National Star.
Yep.
Interestingly, and I'm sure this will come up, because Dave, we've been chatting about it before we came on air. David, his successor, Lynette, was on the show a little while back as well. And I have to say, she was fabulous. She was really, really good.
Good.
I mean, she said very sensible things, very intelligent, very knowledgeable.
And you're saying this to me because?
Well, I just thought I'd open up with the, you know, trying to make you feel at home.
Fine.
Anyway, welcome to Just Not Good Enough, which is all about mental health in business, particularly at board level. Now, obviously, as a CEO, you've been there. You know what board level means. But interestingly, it's the charity sector for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
So let's just introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about, because I think you've been in charity all your career, really?
Well, okay, as a brief introduction, so David Ellis. I've been in charities, as you say, all my career. Started in 1984, way back. Yes, I know, I am that old.
Well, actually, it's a year or two just after me.
So in 84...
Oh, no, actually, it's not. It's more than a year or two. Anyway. Well, sorry.
No, I was going to say. So 84 I started. I went to Africa, went overseas for a couple of years. Yeah, worked as a volunteer over in Sudan. Came back. That was just after university. So came back and then ended up going through a number of different charities in a number of different positions, culminating it, as you say, Chief Exec at National Star for 12 years.
You were at National Trust as well, weren't you?
National Trust was one of the charities I worked at. Guide Dogs for the Blind, Red Cross.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Just a slight aside, I think I may have told you this. There's a guy in our village who's blind, a guy called Derek.
Right.
And you can hear him wandering around because his dog's got a little bell on it.
Oh, right.
And,
okay.
And so I look out the window and shout abuse at him, so, you know, get off my land and all that sort of stuff. But he started Guide Dogs for the Blind, which I find extraordinary.
What was his name?
Derek.
What's his surname?
I don't know.
No, okay, cool.
But and I asked him, I said, did you start that? He says, yeah, I did.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow. Yeah. And from that moment, when I go and buy the papers, I now go to my local shop and I put £1.50 every week in the Guide Dogs for the Blind box.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah. So I just...
So you are generous after all.
yeah. Well, that's debatable. Anyway, look, Carol, so charity sector. Why charity, though?
Oh, you know, big question. It wasn't a conscious decision. You know, when you leave university, you're thinking, oh, what do I do now? And it just seemed like a good idea to go overseas for a couple of years.
Overseas bit I get, but there must be something in you that is compassionate, wanting to help, have a conscience.
I think as a personality, I think there's a big part of my personality that is that. I like to, be in a supportive environment. Helping people wouldn't have to be a charity sector. And believe me, there's a lot of charities that don't fit that description.
Yeah,
we could talk about the word charity because it is a real misnomer.
I can say we're going to come back to that, but let's do it now. What the hell? Let's do it now. So go on then. Tell me why it's a misnomer.
Well, people talk about, and you hear government officials, you hear politicians talk about the charity sector, right?
Yeah.
But then you have to remember that the local community centre is a charity and Eton College is a charity.
Is it?
Oh, yeah, you see? How many people know that, right?
Well, I didn't. I bet hardly anybody knows
Private schools, charities, you know? So when you talk about charity, what do you actually mean? And so that's one I think it's just not a helpful word.
It's a legal status, actually, isn't it?
It is a legal status.
That's probably the only thing that distinguishes it.
That's it. And even not all charities are regulated by the Charity Commission. You can have exempt charities. It's a very complicated beast, the charity sector.
Wow. Because they all position themselves as, you know, philanthropic. I mean, we wouldn't say Eton College is philanthropic, would you?
The Charity Commission, a few years ago, tried to grapple with this problem, and they tried to define what charities are, what you needed to be to define yourself as a charity. And it came up with this useless comment, which said you have to be acting in the public interest. Well, you know, the local petrol station at the bottom of my road is in my public interest when I need to fill up my car.
Yeah.
It doesn't help. It just doesn't help. So, you know, the charity sector as a concept is not helpful.
Yeah, you see, everybody thinks, as I do, you know, oh, he works for a charity. Oh, bloody hell, he must be a really good person who's not material or materialistic, you know, helping others, always out there on the streets, you know, or whatever.
But that's an image, isn't it? It's an image of a word.
Yeah.
And when you stop and analyse, what the last count, I can't remember how many there are at the moment, 160,000, 170,000 charities in this country, and the range of size of charities from hundreds of millions of pounds to 10 grand a year, you know, the turnover of organisations, you can't compare them.
No, but then business is like that, isn't it? You are a business. That's the same thing. You get hundreds
businesses
of pounds.
Are there to make profit for the shareholders.
They are. But so what's the charity? Well, that's a charitable objective, isn't it?
That's the point, isn't it? So if you're running a charity, you've really got to focus in on what the charitable objectives are if you're going to say we're successful or not successful. So one of the most important things for a chief executive is to be really clear about what the charitable objectives. And I've seen charities that do stuff that are nothing to do with their charitable objectives.
Isn't that illegal?
Yeah. But who's going to stop them? That's where the trustee board comes into. You know, interview really.
Yes, the trustee board.
Interesting. Yeah.
Because it's broadly the same. I mean, I've been on both actually, but it's broadly the same as boards of directors for companies, isn't it?
Well, okay, motivation. What's your motivation for sitting on a board of directors for a company, and what's your motivation for being a trustee?
Okay, fair enough. One is money,
yep.
right? And career and advancement and providing for your family and all that sort of shit.
Yep.
And the other is supposedly giving back. But feeling good about yourself.
Can we come back to the giving back comment?
Yes, of course.
Just park that for a minute.
Really?
But
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But the whole point about charity trustees is, I think there's a number of different motivations, but none of it's money, because you can't be paid. Well, actually, that's not strictly true.
No,
but in general...
You were very clear about that. You were never, ever going to pay us.
Oh, quite right.
So everybody knows, I was a trustee, I still am actually, a trustee at National Star, which is where David was CEO, which is how we met. Actually.
Yeah, indeed. So, but it's really important because it goes to the heart of motivation. So why does somebody become a trustee? I could ask you the direct question. Why did you become a trustee?
Well, I was approached, right? And I didn't seek it out.
Right.
I thought, I've got the time and space to do that. I may have something to offer. I don't know. It's giving back. It's it's about being kind, I think, isn't it? And being compassionate to other people.
But there are many, many trustees in the country that do it for different reasons, all right? And I'll tell you one big reason is a social CV. People put it on their CVs so that socially they can say, I'm a trustee of this or I'm a trustee of that, you know, and then look at the whole gong system. You know, how are you going to get an OBE? You know, one of the quick ways is, I'm chairman of that, or I'm chair of this. You know, so I'm not saying by any
That's
means.
That's a bit cynical.
It possibly, but it's realistic as well.
Yes, we've both seen various members of the National Star Trustees who are social CV seekers.
I'm not sure I'd use National Star as a particular example.
No, sorry. Well, but that's my limitation is that plus
Let's bring it back to the role of the chief executive then. One of the key roles of a chief executive is to recruit and retain staff, but that includes the trustee board.
How can you be responsible for people that you're working for?
Great paradox. Well, some of the great truths in life are paradoxical, and that is true for a chief executive, that they are responsible for everything in an organisation, especially in a charity.
Where does the chair come in then?
Okay, so volunteers, for a start. Right? Mm-hmm. So they're not there 9 to 5 all the time. No volunteer, no matter how much time they put into an organisation, can be across the detail of a complex charity that's delivering, you know, tens of millions of pounds of public services. So you've got to recognise the limitations on that model. Doesn't matter what type of person you are. The chief executive has got to be across the detail, and that includes the trustee board.
Yes, you see, I mean, chairmen of PLCs, for example, are probably as involved in the organisation as the chairman of National Star is, right? But, I mean, and they would get paid as well. Obviously, chairman of National Star doesn't. But they are responsible. I mean, if the chief executive's role comes up, the chairman is responsible for replacing it, as indeed happened with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're no longer there now, as we know, because Lynette, who was very good on this show.
You've mentioned that, yeah.
Have I?
Yeah.
Let's hope that bit doesn't get edited out. They're smiling, and may well do. But they're responsible for your recruitment. So then how can you be responsible for their recruitment?
let me put it this way. The chief executive can't abdicate responsibility for the functioning of the trustee board. If the trustee board doesn't function, chief executive's got to sort it out. Let me put it that way. Who else is going to sort it out?
That's interesting, right? Because when I was at Superdry, the behaviour and the functional part of the board was broadly okay, but yeah. There's just one or two people who were frankly fucking obnoxious, actually. Right. And nobody dealt with it. So if there's bad behaviour, it's you. It's not the chairman. It's you that has to call it out.
Look, there will be loads of people who disagree with me, but my firm view, having worked in a lot of charities, is the chief executive's got to sort out a dysfunctional board. The board is an important part of the running of an organisation.
Yeah,
if it doesn't work, chief executive's in charge, got to sort it out. And that means recruiting people that he or she will be accountable to. That's a unique role of a chief executive.
It's very. I've never really thought about it before, but it's the wrong way round, isn't it? I mean, you're recruiting. It's like me recruiting my boss.
Yeah, but that's a very hierarchical view. You at the very top of an organisation, it's a little bit more grey than just, particularly in charities when you're dealing with volunteers who are not there all the time.
Yes, it's the volunteer bit, isn't it?
It's partly that, but don't misunderstand me. Being a volunteer does not imply unprofessional. It doesn't imply that you're doing a bad job or a second-rate job.
No.
Many organisations rely on... Look at the RNLI. You're not going to tell me that the guys and the women who go out on the boats are unprofessional. Look at the Samaritans.
Oh, no.
So I'm not saying volunteering is second class. Use that phrase.
No, I'm not saying that either. It just seems odd. But then I think about my time at Superdry, and Julian was... I wouldn't say responsible for recruiting the non-execs, but he absolutely had a right of veto.
Well, there you go.
So, I suppose it's the same thing.
So the recruitment of a chief executive is critically important to any organisation. If you just bring it back to charities, you know, in my experience, that, you know, if the chief executive and the chair do not get on, then that's not going to work.
Yes, particularly when you're talking about bad behaviour and the pressures that can come when you're in those sorts of positions.
Yeah, that relationship has to be a partnership.
Very strong, actually, as well, doesn't it? So, if you don't get on, that's unbelievably dysfunctional.
Yeah.
Okay, so when we were both at the National Star.
Yeah.
I can't remember you asking me any tricky interview questions. Paul did. Paul Stiles, who's the chair, he asked me a real nasty one right at the end.
Well, he might have been his, or I might have given it to him. I can't remember.
Oh, come on. It was all about my fuck-up with accounts at Superdry. But anyway, we're not going to go there, although we can if we want. But, you see, I've done it. I've forgotten what I was going to say.
you were talking about you joining the Board of Trustees. What do you think about that? Let me just come back to
you talk. So it's better if you talk anyway.
You said one of your motivations for being a trustee was to give back.
Yes.
I hate that phrase.
I hadn't used it.
Then. No, and I'll tell you what, everybody uses it. Not everybody, but loads of people. I'll tell you why. Because it sort of says, it gives the message that you're going to do a proper job, and then when you've made it in life, you're going to just, look around.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'll give a little bit back to the charity
sector. I'm going to take, and then I'm going to give back.
That's the point. Look at the opposite. If you're giving back when you're able to, what does that mean? You're taking when you're not. So people who spend their lives in a caring role, you know.
And never taking. They're always giving back.
So it's a bit insulting. I'm not having to go at you, but that phrase is insulting that... You can only work for charities once you've done something sensible. That's what it implies.
I feel terrible now.
Well, there you go. That's a success for today, isn't it?
Hold on a minute. I live with depression, you know. You can't treat me like that. You can't say things like that to me without it having an effect.
Every day's a school day.
Oh, yeah, I suppose so. But no, actually, you're right. Because when people say it to me as an opportunity to give back, I cringe.
It makes me. And people need to think about what that's saying. And where it's positioning what they're doing. You know, the charity is, I'm only able to do this because I've done something sensible over there.
So what was it for you then?
Well, I said, you touched on it at the very beginning. It's having a career and a life spent, well, a number of things. Doing something that I actually can look back on and think that was valuable, right? So, yes, of course, everyone needs to pay the mortgage and, you know, raise a family, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's that was valuable. I can see the benefit people have got. And when you do something that somebody benefits from, it's really, you know, I get something out of that. So it's not philanthropic in that sense. I'm getting something out of this, just financially. So it's a combination of things, really, isn't it? But when I started, the charity sector was there was no career in the charity sector. There were no organisations and qualifications.
Were you not tempted to go into commerce or banking or financial services or something?
I thought about it, and then I thought, well, as I said at the beginning of my career, I didn't know what to do, so I went to Africa for a couple of years.
Yeah, so, that's not a bad option.
And that affects people. So I come back and you think, well, what am I going to do now? So, you know, I'd worked with aid agencies over there. So I got a job with the Red Cross back here, you know, and then it went from there. And then you realise, you know, you hit your 60s and you realise, oh, God, you know, that was an accident. Didn't mean that happened.
Actually, I know that feeling, yeah. Because I started off not knowing what I wanted to do. Yeah. Still don't, actually.
Well, I think most people just end up in a career and, you know, think, well, okay, this will do now. I need to pay the mortgage, and this is what I know how to do, so I'll stay with it.
And you've been very successful, let's face it. You've achieved CEO. Were you on the exec team at National Trust?
Yes, I was. Yeah, and I was a chief exec. My first chief exec role with the Children's Cancer Charity in Bristol.
Oh, okay.
It was called CLIC, Cancer and Leukemia in Childhood, and I took it through a merger with Sargent Cancer Care. So it's now used to be called CLIC Sargent. It's now it's been renamed since then.
Right.
I forget what it is now, but yeah. So I've been through a number of charities, gaining experience.
So what was it about National Star then that appealed?
I think it's a combination of things. I think the opportunity. So National Star, when I joined, it was very much an educational organisation. Still is in many, many ways.
Yes, it has morphed, hasn't it?
And there was a potential to play the charity card more broadly, in the sense that as a charity, it could do more than it was doing. And that was the challenge, you know. So we have opened up accommodation services. We have opened up other services. We've expanded its sort of remit, if you like.
You that was your vision, was it? When you joined, what was your vision for it? How long did it take you to get to that vision and then think, right, this is what I need to do. This is my purpose in life.
That's an interesting one, because I don't believe that one person, whether they're chief executive or not, should own a vision. I think the chief executive should drive the organisation towards a vision, and then other people should contribute to that. So it isn't one person's vision. If it is, as soon as you change the chief executive, you change the vision.
Well, to a certain extent, that's happened, actually. To a certain extent.
Refined the vision. But my point is that the vision doesn't come from one person. The person in charge needs to enable the organisation to come up with a vision.
Okay, but it's interesting that it sort of changed direction.
And that's an evolution.
When you joined.
Yeah, but that's, yeah, okay. So, and I saw, and that again brings the trustee board into play, because that trustee board ultimately have the yes, no decision on anything that you're going to invest in or do, you know, anything like that.
Yeah, so you have to take them along with you.
That's the point. I mean, theoretically, the trustees set the vision for the charity.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
How on earth are you going to get a group of volunteers together who are not across the detail? So, again, the chief executive needs to... I'm trying to avoid using the word lead, but...
It is. Of course it's lead.
It is lead the trustees towards... Yeah, ultimately, the trustees can say no, back off. And that's their ultimate power.
Yeah. But there's... I mean, some of the things that happened during the time that I've been there, which I think is almost 10 years now, something like that. Like you said, increasing outreach to other places, like Wales and Malvern and Hereford and so on. Residential services, care after leaving the college, long-term residency, in other words. But one of the things, and that's fine, right? Because there's an element of management and finance in all of that, apart from the care. But the decision that was made, I guess, collectively, was that you were going to become more complex in the students that we had.
I tell you what, you're saying, well, how did I get that vision and where did it come from? A again, one of the things that any chief executive of a charity needs to focus on, as well as the charitable purpose, is the unmet need. So we would ask the students, way back when I first arrived, we'd ask the students what they wanted. And one of the, to summarise, they said, we have a great time in this educational environment, you know, learning confidence, learning skills, you know, learning independence, whatever it was. We have a great time here, but now there's nowhere for us to go.
Yeah, that, right? And that's still broadly the case.
So, if you identify an unmet need, and if it's allowable, let me use that word, in a charity's objectives, then why wouldn't you do that? Because you're meeting a need. And that's what the charity exists to do. I know charities, I'm not going to name them, I know charities who sit on piles and piles of cash.
Oh, well, there's one I know.
And don't do anything with it. And the trustees look at it and define success as the balance sheet.
Well, that's the thing that makes them happy, isn't it?
It's they believe that that defines success.
Yeah.
But success for a charity, it has to be measured in its charitable objectives.
Yeah.
And none of the charitable objectives of any charity I know are make money. It's make money in order to do something.
Yes. Well, I mean, isn't that the raison d'etre of them? Is they're non-profit making. So whatever you've got, whatever resources you've got, subject to keeping a bit back in case times get tough, which is fair enough, has to go on services.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So if somebody's not doing that, that's bordering on illegal?
I don't know about the definition of illegal, but certainly unethical. Because if you exist to do something and you don't do it, and you're raising money to do it,
on the back of saying you are going to do it.
Not quite.
Yeah.
So, but it's back to managing a trustee board. The trustees come from, you know, when you joined the trustee board, how much of charity law did you know?
None.
I would say very few trustees understand. Unless you come from a charity, you have no exposure to charity law.
But well, we sort of rely on you for that, though, don't we?
That's my point. That's my point. So the chief executive needs to lead. And if the chief executive thinks
more the finance director.
Well, that comes back to how you can become a successful chief executive. But we'll come back to that.
Yes, we will.
In summary, is you get yourself some very good staff, including a finance director.
Yes, you do. Particularly.
Actually. Yeah. So, but it's about... how do you measure the success of a charity? That's what I'm trying to say. And you cannot do that without going beyond fundraising. You don't raise money. Even the grant givers, you raise money in order to give money out. So you've got to, and that's a real challenge, measuring success.
Okay, so let's, I agree with all of that. I think that's absolutely right. Okay, so how, you've had a number of different trustees over the years, haven't you? So how do you manage them? What do you do? That's a very open question because I can't think of a better one.
It's, God, how do you answer that question? I mean, the first thing I would do is make sure I have a balanced board of trustees who have the right set of values and the right skills to form a group. So you don't replicate. Look, okay, let's go back to National Star. There are some people who are not going to like what I'm going to say, but I'll say it anyway.
Oh, go on, yeah.
When I came to National Star.
Nobody's listening to this, so you're all right.
Well, that's probably just as well. So when I arrived at National Star, there was a joke going around that there's a little village in Gloucestershire, and if you lived in that village, sooner or later you became a trustee of National Star.
There's probably an element of truth in that, isn't there?
There was at the time. All right, over half the trustees came from the village.
Half?
All right, because it's about succession planning. You tap some, you know, you realise you're reaching the end and you've done 6 years or whatever, and so you go to your mate who lives around the corner and you tap him on the shoulder and say, well, how about it? So how your question was, how do I manage the board? Make sure you know what skills you need on the board. Make sure that the personalities are right. And we've had, you and I have both known people who've been on boards who haven't fitted and they've been moved on.
Yes. Yeah?
So you make sure the people who don't fit.
I keep apologising for this for interrupting because just as you're about to get to something, in fact, I've been told off about that by Maddie, who's listening there now, raising her eyebrows. About not letting you get out the bit that's most important. But if I don't say these things, I'm going to forget them.
Okay.
So let's talk about that one incident that we both know about at National Star where the behaviour was, let's say, less than perfect. Can you just sort of run me through that and how you dealt with that?
Can I answer that not in a... Can I avoid answering that practically and answer it from a value base?
Yes, of course. Yes.
Culture. I will come back to the point. So an organisation...
Are you going to talk about the behaviour itself? Or, yeah. Okay, yeah. All right. Because I think it's the behaviour itself that I want to sort of tease out.
Okay, but let me set the scene. Okay. So another key responsibility of a chief executive is organizational culture. A lot of people used to say, oh, that's all airy-fairy nonsense, culture, you know. I think it's the most important thing for an organization.
Right? Particularly a charity, actually.
Right. So organizational culture, in my book, I've always said to people, organizational culture is just another way of describing leadership behavior. Right?
Yes.
So you get a chief executive who blames everyone, you're going to get a blame culture. Right? You get, and we'll touch on mental health here, you get a chief executive who wants to support their staff, you're going to get a supportive culture. People look at the leader and are almost, you know, we could talk about Boris Johnson. In fact, let's. You look at his leadership style and look at the culture it created, right? That's the opposite of what I'm trying to say, right?
Yeah.
No, it's not the opposite of what I'm trying to say. It's the opposite example.
I was at the Literature Festival yesterday, and there's a guy there who was on his advisory board for something.
Right.
I think diversity, actually, because he was a Nigerian.
Okay.
Lovely guy. And he said, Boris's management style was fantastic. He never said...
Abdication.
Sorry?
Was it abdication?
No. He obviously focused on five top things, which is fair enough. But whenever he met him, and he told him what he was doing, he'd say, "Oh, that's brilliant. Can we go further? Can we do more of that? Let's do more of that." Right. So he was very supportive and very encouraging. Whereas actually, the public image of him is he's chaos and he shouts at people.
You can't, as a leader, you can't just be supportive by saying, "Let's do more than that." You've got to put systems and processes and finance and culture in place. He didn't do any of that. Anyway, let's not talk about him. I don't want to talk about him. So.
Not being raised him.
Yeah, you're right.
It's
my fault.
It's quite an interesting topic, actually, having said that. But no, we're here about, broadly, it's about mental health, isn't it?
So I said about culture. So if the chief executive's responsibility is to create the right culture, that means the chief executive is responsible for the culture on the trustee board. Now, if the culture on the trustee board is right, then anyone coming in with the wrong agenda, the wrong values, the wrong approach isn't going to survive in that culture.
The wrong style, language.
So you asked me how I dealt with that behaviour.
But explain the behaviour before you say how you dealt with it.
Oh dear, how would we? Oh, I'd be interested to know how you described it. It was self-interest.
I'd go more descriptive than that, right? So the conversation was going along about something, and the person who was talking was accused of lying. You remember that?
We should name names because I was thinking of a different example. But carry on.
Were you?
Go on.
Let's not. Well, actually, I'd be interested in your example. No. So they were accused of lying, right?
Yes.
And I remember really clearly. I feel really guilty about this, and I should apologise actually to the person because I mean it's a while ago and I still haven't done it for not calling it out. Because one of the things that I am really keen on now, because I'm not in those environments, is calling out the bad behaviour. And I should have said, don't say that. Don't treat that person like that. But I didn't do it. And nobody else did.
Nobody else
in the meeting.
Yeah. So there was a dominant individual. But the culture of that charity is such that you are able to reflect and say, actually, I should have called it out. The culture is still strong enough for you to think, actually, that wasn't right, right? And the culture is strong enough that that individual is no longer there.
Yes, which narrows it down to at least half. That person resigned as a point of principle, didn't he?
But
not because of he was feeling uncomfortable. He got pushed into a corner where what was happening he didn't agree with.
Do you think the other trustees were supportive?
Of him?
Of him.
No.
No, because the culture wouldn't allow that behaviour to survive. So
I don't think it was the behaviour. I think it was what he was standing for. Not, his delivery was appalling, actually. But it's because we were looking to invest in phase two or whatever.
But the point stands that you said to me, how do I manage a trustee board when you get some individuals?
Yeah, go on, haven't come and told me how you've done it.
No, but that is the point. You create a culture that doesn't allow that to survive. I'll give you a wider example. So at National Star, dealing with very vulnerable young adults with complex disabilities, da-di-da, right?
And mental conditions as well.
Yeah. So safeguarding is a big issue.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
How do you safeguard? What's the best thing to do to safeguard? And Lynette probably talked about this because she was a leader in this.
Yeah.
What's the best thing you can do to safeguard vulnerable people in your care is create a culture that doesn't allow any bad behaviour to survive.
And
or
they
flourish.
Feel safe.
Right? So any bad apple that joins, bearing in mind, you know, when I left, there were over 1,200 staff. You can't, as much as you try, someone might
slip
through. Well,
we did have a few bad ones, didn't
right?
we?
Right. So the way you protect, the best way to protect is to make sure the culture doesn't allow the bad apple to infiltrate, to affect other people, behaviour gets called out. The other staff that are working with them just, you know, raise it. But that comes back not to processes are important, policies are important, but culture is dominant.
Yeah.
And if the people around that individual say, that's out of order, and the same applies at trustee level. If the trustees say, that was none, even if they don't call it out at the time, on reflection, if the other trustees say, that's out of order, that behaviour is not going to survive.
Okay, so talk me through what you did then. Because nobody said anything in the meeting.
Yeah.
And I went away from there actually feeling my switch had kicked in. And I felt really bad about myself. I felt guilty. I felt shameful because I hadn't said anything, but I didn't feel brave enough. I was a coward, right? So tell me what you did. You know, meeting closed. We all go home. What happened then?
It's back to the balancing act at the top of an organisation, recognising the trustees are ultimately the boss and are in charge and can instruct a chief executive, but the chief executive needs to make sure the trustees are working properly, right? It's that balancing act, right? So.
But you've got a toxic situation on your hands,
right,
haven't you?
So the first thing
which
to
isn't
do,
the first time it had happened, I might say.
First thing to do is to make sure the damage is limited. All right. So if people are called, these are executive members, paid members of staff who are called out inappropriately in a meeting by a trustee. First thing to do is make sure those staff members are okay. That's what I did.
And they were.
Immediately after the meeting, we had a short gathering. Let's not call it a meeting. Right, and I made sure that the messages that they'd received from an individual were not the messages that I felt as chief executive. I gave them positive feedback and told them that that was unacceptable behaviour, and I would talk to other people about it, and which is what I did. I went out and talked to the chairman and others about that.
And what was the response from the chairman particularly?
Very supportive. But it comes back to culture because the
chairman... Shouldn't he have called it out?
It's difficult, isn't it? It's a question
of... It is hard. I know, it's really hard.
It is difficult. It's about... I think it's more important not to let it grow.
Yeah, don't let it fester.
Maybe it's about, is it appropriate to call it out in public? Is it appropriate to call that individual aside after the meeting? Is it appropriate to do something else? I don't think there's a blueprint on that, other than don't let that behaviour go unchallenged in one way or another.
Yeah, you see, I remember it so clearly because it haunts me a little bit, I must say, right? Which is not good for my well-being, actually, as it turns out. But I felt that he had got away with it. And I wasn't aware of all the stuff that was going on behind the scenes. And I always think that these things need to be called out in the moment because they need to know that what they've just said is unacceptable. Because the mood changed in the meeting immediately after that. And for me, never recovered, actually.
I think, yeah.
And future meetings as well, I might add.
I think in general, you're probably right. But all I'm recognising is that it's difficult because there's, you know, there are other things happening at the time. And, you know, it's just you need to make a decision on how best to deal with it. And calling it out publicly is not always the right thing.
Can I just... point out to a different thing about you and I, right? And we've spoken about this before because we do personality tests quite often. Well, I used to. I don't anymore because it frightened me. But you're an introverted thinker and I'm an extroverted thinker. And if I could summarise that, my extroverted thinking is I respond to what somebody said in front of me at the moment.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And if I was to sit down and try and write something creative, my mind would be a complete and utter blank because there's no stimulus. Right?
Okay.
Whereas an introverted thinker, and I'm sort of using extremes, and they may not be very good definitions, is somebody who takes in something, goes away, thinks about it, makes up their mind, and comes back.
Reflector.
Yeah. And I think you're in that camp and I'm in the former camp.
Yeah.
And is that something then that led the way that you dealt
with it?
Yes,
of course. Yes, of course. Because, you know, in general... whether it's chief executive or anybody else, you have to be genuine. You cannot play a role, right? You have to be who you are with your strengths and your weaknesses. So as a reflector, I would go and reflect on something before I decided how to respond to it. Not always. But all I'm saying is, in general, at the top of an organization, you cannot pretend to be something you're not. That
you get found out.
Yeah, and also it's exhausting. Just putting that face on, that facade, you know. So I would say to any chief executive, just be who you are. And that's the wider point on that one, is recognize your weaknesses and cover them off with the rest of your staff.
That's an old trick, isn't it? It's not a trick. It's a very sensible thing to do.
But it goes to a really important point about being chief executive, which is recruitment of your senior staff. Do you recruit senior staff that you can control, that aren't a threat to you? Or do you recruit senior staff who are a mirror image so you can get on with them? Neither. You recruit senior staff to cover your gaps.
Yeah.
But the one thing that has to be true is the value base that you all operate from needs to be the same.
Yeah. Yeah, because you have to recognize that people are human beings and we all have vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
So just on that.
So there's this one, and I cannot remember where it comes from, probably from royal family or something during the war. Anyway, there's this phrase about never explain and never apologize if you're a leader. That's absolute nonsense.
Thank God you said that. I was thinking that's terrible.
It's exactly the opposite of what a good leader does.
Yeah.
The good leader will always explain why they've done something and always apologize when you... But, you know, this... particularly a macho leadership style is, I can't admit weakness. Absolute nonsense.
You see that?
As soon as you admit weakness, you know, and if you've got the right culture, your staff will cover you. You look after your staff, the staff will look after you.
Yeah.
That's a real truism.
It's interesting, because if you've got a vulnerability, like a disability, yeah, like a lot of our students have, and some of our staff for that matter, it's visible. You can see it, right?
Yeah.
If you've got a mental condition, you can't see it.
Yeah.
So it's not visible. So, and you mentioned this a little while ago about putting up a facade.
Yeah.
Right. And you found out that I had depression in, I don't know, 2018 or something like that.
Yeah.
But beforehand, you didn't know. But I had this, I used to hide behind personality and humor and interaction and reacting in the moment, right? Which is my personality, but sometimes it, bloody hell, now I've cost you a lot to do it.
Yeah.
And it's not being me.
Yeah. Right?
But what I didn't want to do, being a macho finance person, is say, actually, guys, look, I'm feeling shit today.
But society's got a role to play there, because, you know, being in a wheelchair, much less stigma than having a mental health problem. It's getting better.
It never used to be.
No.
But the point being that being in a wheelchair has got a hell of a lot better and easier for people.
And mental health challenges are on the same trajectory.
Yes,
it is getting better and the stigma is getting less, but it's still there. So I would assume that you were reluctant to talk about it because of the stigma.
I was. I also didn't have the language to be able to do it, actually, but that's another side to it. But it was also because I was in fear of losing my career.
Yeah.
You know, and when you're ambitious, as a lot of finance people tend to be, you know, as do other people, of course, in other professions, finance particularly, and we tend to be not renowned for our empathy. You know, we are numbers
driven.
Your
words, not mine.
I know, yes, it is my words, correct. It is numbers driven and so on. So admitting a weakness, you're creating a little hole for somebody else to jump into. So you don't. And I just think that's appalling.
Okay, if the culture is stab each other in the back, then yes, I can see why. So again, you're back to what culture in the organization.
Yes.
If the culture in the organization is one of mutual support, all right, then that opportunity is significantly reduced. I'll give you the example at National Star. So the culture at National Star, I work for a number of charities, right? A number of big charities.
Mm.
National Star knocks the spots off absolutely all of them. And one of the reasons for that is the culture of it. The culture was focused on the beneficiaries. Let me use that word.
Yeah.
So every single person
on the student
was, what's the right decision for the students? We'll come back to the one of my highlights of my career is getting the trustees to break the law, but maybe we shouldn't talk about that.
Oh, what, a national star?
Yeah.
God, was I there?
Yes, maybe we shouldn't talk about that.
No, go on. I'm really interested now all of a sudden. But I mean, forget the rest of what we said. I'm not having to know about that bit, but yeah, go on.
But so it's and I know I'm labouring a point, but if the culture of the organisation is focused on what's right for the beneficiaries, then stabbing your colleague in the back, how's that going to help the beneficiaries? So the culture is very powerful. If you get the right culture, it's very, very powerful.
But it's about advancement, isn't it? But I think this is going to sound terrible, but the people who work in charities perhaps aren't as ambitious as somebody who works in a bank.
No. No, now you're back to giving back. So you're back to the, yes, you're back to the two-tier system of, so I go and work in a bank because I'm ambitious, and I go and work for, I don't know, Guide Dogs for the Blind because I'm not.
No. Sorry. Yeah, it's too black and white. It's not like that at all. But the rewards, the financial rewards and the material rewards, which is how a lot of people are judged.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are higher in commerce and financial services and places like that than they are in charities, because you know charities are at the bottom half of the pay sector.
So that is, in general, that's true. So why do people work in charities?
They do it for other reasons.
They do it for many, many other reasons. I mean, it's the work they enjoy. It is the people that they work with. There's some lovely people. There's some complete nasty psychopaths working in charities as well. Yeah. You know, it doesn't matter. And actually, some of the people work in charities because they see easy pickings. You know, they see it as, oh, I want to get on, and oh, these people are just do good. They're not going to stop
me.
Oh, I've seen that.
That's the worst possible reason.
Yeah, of course. But all I'm saying is, it's not, you know, just because you work in a charity doesn't make you, you know, a nice person. I mean, there are loads of nice people there, but it's the same with any other sector you get.
No, but you say, I've worked in charities. I worked at National Trust. In fact, we were there at the same time, weren't we? Although we'd never met, which is fortunate. but this is going to sound terrible as well. It's a slightly softer culture because people are there because it is about the charitable objectives and the purposes.
We go back to charity definition. Most charities are there to support a certain group of beneficiaries, whether it's people with disabilities, whether it's, you know,
it's
children,
buildings.
Or
making buildings available to the public. Yeah, that sort of stuff. And gardens.
We can talk about why the National Trust is a charity. That's a very interesting topic of conversation.
No, we won't go there. That's not mental health, is it?
But
although we might do it after this.
Yeah. But in general, you're right. It is a softer, and I think it's a softer culture in the way that the caring professions in general, whether you're a charity or not, is a softer culture.
It doesn't make it any less professional.
No.
Or competent.
No.
Or anything like that. But, you know, if you had two people who are exactly the same, one is a combatant and the other isn't, you know, one would probably go to charity and one would go to a bank.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, in general.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but then the people who go to bank are surrounded by people who are like that in the bank.
Yes.
So therefore,
you're back to culture.
You're back to culture, but you're also back to a stronger stigma about not holding your hand up and saying, I've got a vulnerability.
Yeah, because the culture won't allow it.
Yes.
And that, so you're back to, if you want to go back to mental health, the chief executive is responsible for creating an environment that is allowed to be dealt with. And the people who put their hand up are allowed to be supported, not criticised. So, if I was to have one message from all of this, it is the chief executive has to create the environment, the culture that allows that to be dealt with positively.
Yeah. Up until now, these conversations actually always change my mind a little bit, right? And that I've just had a change of mind then. Because up until now, I've said it's got to be the chairman or possibly the chief executive that gives that permission to people.
Yeah.
But I'm wrong. It's the chief executive. You are right.
I think, that's the first time you've ever said that to me.
Well, that you're right.
Yeah, but I'll take it.
Can we edit that bit out, please?
But it is, think about it this way, is if the chief executive didn't do it, is anyone else going to do it? Does anyone else have the levers to do it?
Well, of course they're not, because they're then behaving not like the chief executive. Yeah. And if you want to get on and be successful,
you mirror the leader.
Yeah, the behaviour just drifts down the organisation. Yeah. So if you get a beating, you go and beat your staff up.
Yeah. Yeah.
How fair is that?
Yeah. So leadership behaviour is organisational culture. It's all about leadership behaviour.
Okay, so you've got a narcissistic, arrogant twat of a CEO.
Yeah.
How do you get them to change?
To change, or how do you remove them?
No, get them to change.
Because
they might be really successful at their job. You know, the business might be doing fantastically well. That's a tough question, actually, now I think about it.
I suppose my hesitation there is the business doing as well as it would if they had a different type of chief executive?
No, that's a cop-out.
No, it isn't. It's about how are you measuring success. So you're measuring success because that organisation generates £10 million for shareholders, right?
Yeah.
How do you know it can't make £20 million with a better chief executive? It doesn't mean...
No, you can't. That's like saying I was going to spend £100 on advertising, but which 50 is the right one?
Exactly.
You can't say that. So okay. So it's in some ways it's an unanswerable argument.
So, okay. So would you leave that type of chief executive in place because they're generating 10 million quid? Or would you deal with it?
If I was a shareholder,
yeah,
right, and this gets to the crux of the bit that I find really difficult, is PLC boards have a lot of stakeholders, right? So you've got this fabulous chief executive whose behavior is nigh on perfect, right? And okay, they're doing well for the shareholders, right? Or you've got an arsehole of a chief exec and they're still performing well for the shareholders. At the end of the day, the shareholders don't give a toss, actually. They do not care. They care to the extent that what that chief exec is seen to be doing is supporting his staff and, you know, creating the right culture and so on. But once they've ticked that box and it's written up in the annual report about all these well-being initiatives that they're doing, you know, that's fine. It's done. How much money are you making?
Okay.
And so the pressure on a chief executive to make money from shareholders, and I'm thinking specifically about public companies here, is the only thing that they're bothered about. So the behaviour, you can get away with all sorts of shit.
You seem to be implying that the shareholders don't care how the money's made as long as the money is made.
No, and I'm not saying that. No. What I'm saying is that as long as the chief executive and the board, for whatever that is, and the organisation is doing the right things for culture, that's... what am I saying? I don't know that that would dictate or make the decision for investment for them.
So that comes back to, it's a much broader question, which is why do people put their money where they put their money? So you go to Sainsbury's and do you buy organic bananas or do you not? Or do you buy fair trade bananas or do you not? That's you choosing where to put your money because of the values that you see that are important to you behind the product you order. Same applies to shareholders. Would you put your money into an organisation where the chief executive is a complete narcissist who bullies his staff?
Well, I probably have.
Yeah.
Right? Because so Arcadia, you think of Arcadia, okay, right, with Mr Green.
Okay.
You know, I mean, there's some horror stories about him, and a friend of mine used to deal with him. So, you know, I've got some first-hand anecdotes.
If you know. So the pressure is on the shareholders, and this is the limitations, isn't it? If the shareholders don't care how the money's made, and they know about the behaviour of a chief executive, and they still fund it, then that's up to the shareholders.
It is, but sometimes we don't have a say because it's stuck up in pension funds and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But then you think about the bigger shareholders, right? They will ask the right questions about the ESG agenda. Yeah. But at the end of the day, they're managing money for other people whose pension pots.
Well, but that's a much broader question about how the government controls investments and how the government controls
up,
finance.
Up to a point. The point I'm making, though, is that it's the shareholders that dictate how a board behaves because that's the pressure that's being put on them to be successful financially.
Yep.
And that then dictates how they behave down their organisation, doesn't it?
So why do you think I'm not working for shareholders? Why do you think I work in the charity sector where you don't have... Mind you, there are a lot of stakeholders...
So you
go to National Star, you've got stakeholders coming out your ears.
Oh, you've got exactly the same amount of stakeholders, right?
Yeah.
But the key bit is that money is not necessarily the prime agenda.
No.
Funding is.
Yes.
But actually it's about the charitable objectives.
Private sector
and
fundamentally
influencing
is about...
government.
Yeah,
and
private
all
sector is
things.
About making money. At the end of the day, you can talk about, you know, airlines being the primary objective is flying people to Australia. It isn't. It's about making money.
Yes.
Right. So, but the primary objective, exactly right. The primary objective in the charity sector is charitable objectives, which is why I started there, which is why that is so important.
In a way, I'm envious of you, actually, because I do enjoy my charity work now.
Yeah. Right?
But I don't think I could. I don't think I'm the right person to have made a career of it.
Well, you don't know, do you?
No, that's one of those questions, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a what if question.
It's a sliding doors moment, isn't it?
What, on but Star maybe, Trek?
Yeah, no. It's the Gwyneth Paltrow film, but let's not go there.
Well, I don't know that one.
All right. So, yeah, it's... But you're contributing, you know, as long as you don't say giving back, and you're contributing now.
It's true. Although yeah. I have a revelation. I said that before. I was going to have a revelation. I may have said it on here, actually.
Go on.
I'm thinking very seriously about giving up all of my charitable positions.
Because...
I've got to the point where it's becoming, I would say it's a chore, but it's not helping my mental well-being, actually.
Okay, okay.
And, I mean, I don't tell anybody, although I just potentially have. And it's, I don't feel, I don't know how to put this, actually, but my incidence of going into bouts of depression has increased in the last year. I would say,
and you're linking that to the work you do,
only because that's the bit that I can actually get rid of, if you like. I think it's about because I'm trying to do too much, and my personality is that I want to be busy all the time. So I've got to learn how to do to free up some space and declutter, I think, and one of the easiest ways of doing that is to stop charitable work.
Okay.
And retire, you know, because well, that's where you are, isn't it?
Because you're an old man now.
I am, I know, yeah. I know. And so are you, I might add. But that's where you are. So how's retirement for you? I mean, have you transitioned okay?
Well, still in the process, I think is the phrase. So it's interesting, isn't it? So I did 12 years at National Star.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people were a bit surprised when I said I was moving on. Number of different reasons for that. Work reasons were we'd just been through 2 years of COVID.
Yeah, that can't have been easy for anybody, frankly.
And we kept the whole place open and running through COVID. Decision for trustees.
Yeah.
Breaking the law. We should come back to that.
Oh.
But anyway, so that was hard. That was hard, especially when dealing with an incompetent government who keep giving... I mean,
you know, I thought you were saying incompetent trustees.
No, not at all. The trustees were great. Absolutely great.
Some in particular?
Yeah, some not so much. But no, and 12 years, you realise that actually, you know, I love the organisation, still love the organisation.
So do I,
But you know that actually, for the sake of the organisation, sometimes you just need, it's a relay race. And if you hang on to the baton, you know, on the home straight, you're knackered. You're going to be running slower than everybody else. You need to hand that baton over. And I knew that it was the right time to hand the baton over, as difficult as it was. So,
On reflection, I think you're right. Actually, I mean, I really enjoyed working there whilst you were there.
Yeah.
Right. Can we edit that bit out as well? but I think, yeah, there comes a point where you sort of run out of steam a bit.
Sometimes it needs new blood, it needs new energy, it needs somebody younger, quite honestly, and it just needs a fresh approach. It just needs freshening up.
Yeah.
I'll come back to charitable purpose. It doesn't need to change the overall vision. You know, it doesn't need to change the charitable objectives. You just need to pick up the baton and someone with a bit more, I don't know, someone to refresh it. Right. And that's true with trustees, as it is at management.
You see, that's going through my mind as well
is
about freshening up because I mean technically I've come to the end of my 9 years, three-year terms, right? I'm in my 10th year now, right? And they've given me another year, and I'm thinking there's a reason for three-year stints, because it is about freshening up.
It's a risk, though, a real risk. You put a new chief executive in who's got an ego problem. Right, then they will change the culture of the organisation. You've got chief executives who think that their job is to create the vision rather than create consensus on a vision. Then they're going to do something new, rebrand it because they want to look something. They want to be different to the predecessor.
Tell me what happened at National Trust then about
there.
Chairman. Was it the chairman or the chief exec?
No, well,
they came in and they just...
Oh, no, I think that was a charity that was a long time ago.
Oh, was it? But was that not National Trust?
No, I've seen a lot of charities whereby chief executives and chairs have come in and tried to dominate. Now, maybe that other people will say that was appropriate. I don't think that's the right thing to do. I think that the role of chair is to create a board that's united and working together. Role of chief executive is to give a sense of direction and create the culture that the organization needs. So a change of either at any point is risky. Now, if the charity's not working, if it's something's broken, then it doesn't become a risk. It becomes an opportunity, doesn't it? But if it's working well, then it becomes a risk. So, and also,
does mean you shouldn't do it though?
No, it doesn't. No, absolutely not. And again, you know, when I retired, that was in my view, the organisation was working well. So
yeah,
it was very important to hand over to somebody who could keep it working well
and to just take
and
it
not
to the,
derail it,
take it to the next stage. Because if you think if you'd been there, in 10 years' time, you know, we'd still be doing the same things in the
but
world
that's
that
about,
have moved on.
Yeah, but that's exactly the point about refreshing it.
Yes,
that's about
refreshing it. Yeah.
So you need a chief executive who's going to be focused on the right culture to keep it going. You know,
which she is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I was of the view that it needed an internal candidate when I stood down. But, you know, there were
there were
other arguments.
Oh,
but,
really? But it was obvious, wasn't it? I mean, there were two really strong candidates,
yeah,
and if
yeah.
one didn't want to get it or do it,
yeah.
then the
yeah.
other one would have been equally
yeah, exactly.
as good.
Yeah, yeah.
So actually, as it turns out, you were very well protected, weren't you?
Yeah, in my own defence, I wasn't. That wasn't an accident.
You don't need to defend a statement like that. David, we've covered a hell of a lot, actually. A hell of a lot. Is there anything else, particularly in relation to depression, that you'd want to add? I think the bit actually about when you found out where I was suffering with depression. What? How did that change you? If indeed it did.
It made me reflect on the way I was going to say dealt with you. That sounds quite strong, doesn't it? The way I was with you, because you like a laugh, and sometimes you hide behind humour.
I do.
And the banter, so we had banter.
Yeah.
But sometimes I reflected on whether or not that banter was cutting deep and you weren't showing it.
That's very astute of you, actually, because yours didn't, but sometimes it does. And people just go a tiny, tiny bit too far.
Yeah.
And that just sends me spiralling down into a black hole.
Yeah.
You know. And it all comes flooding back and the mood changes and then I'm fit for nothing, frankly, for a little while. But the fact that you did that, would you have known if I hadn't told you that I had depression?
No, I wouldn't. No, I couldn't have read it in your face and I couldn't have read it in your behaviour.
Yes, because a lot of people do hide it. Again, this comes back to the stigma that we were talking about.
Yeah.
But that just then puts the onus on me. It's not the onus, but it means about having a psychologically safe environment for me to tell people.
Yeah. So okay, you nearly said there it's your responsibility to tell
people.
I did. Right? But it was my responsibility to create the environment that you felt safe to tell people.
Yeah.
So a chief executive must assume there are some people, beneficiaries, staff, volunteers, trustees, whoever, who might be suffering from, if you want to just focus on mental health, and create the culture, create the environment that allows that to happen. Now, whether you choose to then use that and declare the challenges that you've had, that's your responsibility. But my responsibility is creating the environment, you know, and I'm not sure I consciously did that, but when you told me, I reflected on whether or not it was a safe environment. I concluded that it was.
Wow. Well, yeah, to be honest, yeah, and God's truth, I mean, the environment is unbelievably safe psychologically.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think you might have been the one first person I told or pointed in the direction of my...
Yeah, possibly.
Whatever it was.
Yeah.
I don't know. But did I tell you before that radio show?
Yeah, you told me because I think you were concerned that I would hear it and then be... and find out without you telling me. So I think you wanted to tell me before the whatever radio show it was.
Yeah, so I probably did feel psychologically more safe at National Star than absolutely... anywhere
well,
else.
I'll take that as a compliment then.
Do. But just coming back to board constitution,
right,
the makeup of boards, it's mostly, certainly in my, when I was at Superdry, it was broadly white male. Yeah, we did have the odd woman and the odd Asian and so on, that's fine. And three or four of the eight or nine non-execs were accountants. Yeah. And in not at retirement, well, probably are, were at retirement age, or doing it as a side job, if you like, because they were finance director of another yeah. organization, seeing it as part of their career development, career experience. Yeah. And these people are not renowned for changing their behavior like you did.
Yeah.
And so then many places are never, ever going to have that environment where people feel safe to say something. And let's face it, most, if not all, of the conversations that go on are behind closed doors.
Okay.
And nothing appears in the minutes, of course.
So I've been banging on about this, and I'm going to labour the point. It's about leadership. It's the critical importance of leadership. Look, we in this country today, my personal view is, we are suffering from a catastrophic failure of leadership in every sector. All right?
That's a big statement.
Maybe. But you look around and you ask yourself, who are the leaders that I really respect? Right? So was it John Simpson on the BBC said he'd for 40 years he's in interviewing political leaders and there's only three he actually thought were great.
That doesn't surprise me, yeah.
And it was people like Zelensky.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah. Mandela.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you think, who are the other fantastic leaders? Look around at the moment. Look at the political chaos. That is down to a failure of leadership. Yeah. So my point is this, that the leader of any organization, no matter what it is or where it is, has a key role in creating the environment to allow challenges like mental health challenges to be dealt with in a safe environment. It's a leadership responsibility.
Do you think that opens them up to being usurped?
In what sense?
Well, because if a political leader, those two that you mentioned,
yeah,
apart,
yeah.
If they suddenly come off all soft and fluffy, put again in an obvious, whatever it is term, that opens them up to attack, doesn't it?
Attack if you're in the wrong culture.
But it's quite hard to create a culture in an opposition party.
Mandela was attacked, literally and figuratively, all his life. You know, he still stuck to what he believed was right in terms of strong leadership. It depends what you mean by strong, doesn't it? So, it's a serious point. I'd challenge anyone to look around this country today and identify three or four good leaders in any sector.
There's a period of silence now because I'm trying to rack my brains. And
now, there are good leaders, but they tend not to be high profile.
Yeah.
Right? Because a leader who wants a high profile, you have to then challenge that motive. Why do you want a high profile? And people say to me, I've got to have a high social media profile as leader because, you know, I'm the face of the organization. No, the organization needs a high social media profile.
Yeah.
But you, as the chief executive, don't need to tell people what you had for breakfast.
No.
Yeah?
No. You see, this is a ridiculous parallel, but football managers, right?
Yeah.
They're two types, really. Along one dimension that I'm talking about. Is you get the manager who, when they win the cup, is right in the middle with the cup, holding it aloft with the players.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking Alec Ferguson.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then another manager who just lets the players have their moment and stands on the side. And I'm thinking Brian Clough.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and okay, Alex Ferguson was very successful. Brian Clough, I arguably was more successful because he did it with a second size city. Yeah. And won unbelievably. It was unbelievably successful because he created the right environment and I guess the right culture for that group of players to succeed.
Yeah, it leadership. And it is back to leadership. Yeah. And I would say that it's not a well-respected concept, although it's gaining traction. And that is the whole concept of servant leadership. And that is that as a leader, you serve your organization. It's the word servant that people trip over. Yeah. Because servant does not mean you are there to do as other people tell you or you are there to do other people's bidding.
No.
To serve an organization means you need to create the culture. You need to serve it. You need to serve your staff, give them what they need to flourish.
Yeah.
So leaders everywhere need to think about what serving their organization means. Yeah. And I was really interested to hear Keir Starmer talk about service. In his speech at Liverpool.
Okay.
He talked about being ready to serve. And that's the first time
I've
heard...
And they all say that, David.
No.
Liz Truss said it's been an honour to serve.
I know that you're a secret Tory.
Wonder if she was on the way out.
No, I'm going to challenge that. Because most, particularly the Tories, will talk about when they get power. And other people, and Labour have done that as well, right? But occasionally you get someone say, when we are in a position to serve... But you listen. Most people say, when we get power, and that tells you everything you need to know about what they are driven by.
Yes. You see, I because of my well-being, I actually don't listen to the news really anymore.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Because, and I don't read newspapers.
Yeah.
Just as an example, right, local news where I live in the Southwest, half an hour between 6:30 and 7 or something. Yeah. And I just did a random survey. The first 20 to 25 minutes of that was about crime reporting.
Yeah.
And then at the tail end, you get this token gesture of somebody who's, you know, owned a zoo or something like that. You know, and I just think, oh, my God, it's just too depressing, frankly.
Leadership, leadership. Leadership? Media leadership.
Yes.
Right? Who's setting the agenda about what gets shown on the news? Who's setting the agenda about what leads the news articles?
But the public, right?
Is it?
Yes, it is, because the public wouldn't watch it if they didn't.
Don't agree.
Viewing figures.
Don't agree.
No.
That's the argument that says, I wouldn't buy the newspaper if I didn't want to read it. No. I think that the public are, in general, sitting there watching what's being put in front of them, and they, in general, they're reading what was on the front cover of the newspapers.
Yes, right? they are. But, so they're being, they wouldn't do it if they genuinely weren't interested. Why don't they have a whole programme then of do-good stories? Because nobody would watch it. Nobody's titillated by it.
It's one of those, you know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we could talk a little bit about
you can't prove it on one way or the other.
Yeah, yeah. but I just know I'm right.
Anyway. As per always.
As always, yes. David, look, honestly, it's been an absolute pleasure. We do meet occasionally, don't we,
for a
beer.
Yes.
Although, as I remember, you let me down and still haven't paid me the cash for my pint that I bought on your behalf. When I go to Malvern.
But you're a rich finance director, aren't you? Or were.
Look at Superdry shares. Really, Jesus Christ. Thank you so much for coming in. Honestly,
no,
I am sure we are going to continue these conversations. I might secretly have a microphone, actually, to record you, unbeknownst to you, to get your real feelings out. It's been a great. Thank you ever so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Cheers.